The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition. We're on today's show. Sounds like we have quite a mix of different topics that we're going to cover. Jim's got a big old pile of questions. At his remote location, we're still social distancing, so we are not in the studio together. Once again, that's going to be why he sounds a bit different than I do. He's calling in from his, I don't know what you'd call it, his bunker. Wherever you're hunkered down for protection against all things viral. So he'll have to give us the topics, but I think we've got some CARES Act items, maybe a couple things I know we need to clear up from some past shows. We'll probably do that first, but hello, Jim, are you there?
I am here, and I wouldn't call it a bunker. I'd call it my kitchen.
Well, a bunker sounds more protective.
True, then my kitchen. My kitchen doesn't sound that protective. But I don't have a office in the house. I figure, why have an office in the house when I got a 3,000-square-foot office in Fort Collins? So my kitchen table has been acting as my office. And it works. You can tell I'm a bachelor, because if you saw my kitchen, it absolutely is no longer a kitchen. It's more of an office. But it works for me. Okay. Yeah, we do have a lot we're going to go over today. Hopefully I sound a little better. Chris is keeping me from using my wireless headset that he bought me. Apparently it's a cheapo one that makes me sound tinny.
It's not cheapo.
Well, it makes me sound tinny.
There's a trade-off for convenience.
Well, if that's a tiny one, I'd hate to see what the large ones are like, because that thing, I put it on and my whole head weighs to the right. Thing, it's not a light, small little thing. It's not like those things that I see people walking around in the stores with, you know, the people with the little thing in their ear, like they got to answer the phone right at the crack of dawn. But this thing is pretty big, and apparently it doesn't sound as good. So he is making me sit at my kitchen table holding my phone. And I am, first of all, from the East Coast, second of all, Portuguese. You throw both of those together, and I talk with my hands, and I get all fired up when I talk, and I can't do that, so
can't
I don't
hold it
like
against
it.
Your shoulder?
I don't like this at all. At least in the recording studio, Chris, if you saw us recording, Chris just kind of sits there, and me, my hands are flailing all over as I'm talking, and Chris just sits there very quiet like, and me, you just get no way near me if I'm recording, because you're going to get smacked in the face. But here I got to hold the phone, so I don't really like it. Okay, before we get into two emails that corrected Chris on mistakes he made, and this time they still do the mistake, Chris. They spell your name J-I-M, but...
Well, one of them was me saying something.
One of them was you, and I think he did spell Chris correctly, C-H-R-I-M.
That one.
Yes. The other one...
The other one was
I'm
a joint
sure.
effort, yeah.
Yeah, the other one might have been a joint effort, but we will get to those because when we say something that could be misunderstood or may not quite be accurate, we do rely on our listeners to point these out to us. So we want to clear the air on a few things. But before we do that, I had a homework assignment, if you remember, from our CARES Act show we did, I believe, a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I said I would reach out to the Ed Slot group. We actually had an email question on this, and I cannot find the email question. I know it's in my stack of stuff somewhere, but hopefully the person who sent the question is listening, because I used his question as a basis for a question to the Ed Slot group. And I'm just going to actually go through, folks, the email that I sent to the Ed Slot group to clear the air on. And if you remember, Chris, what we were questioning back and forth when this CARES Act came out was the $100,000 you can withdraw from an IRA or a retirement account if you have a COVID-related expense or COVID-related, what do they call it? COVID-related withdrawal. Mm-hmm. If you qualify for it, and I'll walk through what that means to have a COVID-19-related withdrawal. But they're going to allow you to take $100,000 out if you qualify. That $100,000, the taxes on it can be spread out over 3 years. And you can also put the money back into your IRA or your 401k over that three-year period. It's kind of like a 60-day rollover, if you will, Chris, on steroids. Mm-hmm. They're going to let you take it out, use it to cover expenses, and then hopefully when things settle down and you start making money again, put it back into the IRA. So we started coming up with a bunch of questions related to that. Some of which were, could you take the $100,000 out, assuming you qualified for the COVID-related withdrawal, and put it in a Roth IRA and spread the taxes out over 3 years? And that's essentially what I wanted to ask. And we got an email question similar to that. He asked, could I, and I'm have to go over this question not by reading it. I'm going over it by memory. So hopefully I'll find the person who asked this question. But what they asked essentially is, assuming they qualified for the withdrawal, could they take the withdrawal, the $100,000, put the $100,000 off to the side and invest it in a regular brokerage account, and at the end of 3 years, replace the $100,000 in a Roth IRA, and in the meantime, get to keep all the interest or earnings that the $100,000 generated for 3 years. So using that as the basis, I asked the Ed Slot group that question. And I'm going to actually read my email to them and their reply back to you. So that way, everyone listening can hear what they had to say. And recognize when I communicate with the Ed Slot group, there is Ed, and there are three what he calls technical consultants. Is that the same verbiage that Social Security uses for their representatives in the office who know everything?
I think they call them technical experts instead of
technical
consultants.
Technical experts. Okay. Ed calls them technical consultants. So he has three technical consultants, and then there's Ed. I email them. I email the three of them. I don't email Ed. And then the three of them will confer amongst themselves and with Ed, and everyone replies via email. So we can see and track who is saying what. And for the most part, they all agree. There was only once, I forget when it was, but there was once where there was a little point of contention between them. And it's kind of like I instigated a little bit of an argument back and forth that some agreed with one way of looking at things, others thought the other, and they came to the consensus that they just didn't really have an opinion. And it was an interesting case. I won't get into what that case was. But on this one, they all drew the same conclusion. So let's walk through my email to them, Chris, and it walks through exactly that scenario, okay?
Okay.
Alrighty. So I began. Everyone is hearing about the 100,000. This is me talking to the Ed Slot group. Everyone is hearing about the 100,000 you can withdraw for a COVID-19 related issue. The rules are rather liberal on this withdrawal, and many people, including those who may not be directly suffering a deep financial impact, but could still qualify under the rules established for this withdrawal, may be able to take $100,000 out. And then they took my email, stopped it there, and typed in a warning. They said, Jim, keep in mind that not everyone qualifies for the $100,000 withdrawal. The individual or their family member must be diagnosed with COVID-19. Or the individual IRA owner must have suffered an adverse financial consequence as a result of certain specified conditions in the act, including being quarantined, being laid off, furloughed, having their hours reduced, or having to provide child care. So I just wanted to mention that again, folks. And Chris, you and I covered this at length when we did our COVID-19 our CARES Act discussion. You just can't take $100,000 out, can you, Chris?
No, you've got to qualify. They're fairly liberal rules behind it. So, and they also don't say you have to prove the dollar amount. So there's quite a bit of wiggle room in there, but you do have to have a qualifying effect or you've been affected in a qualifying way from the whole COVID-19 crisis.
Exactly. And don't forget the last item listed under the rules of who qualifies and doesn't qualify is any other reason deemed acceptable, essentially, by the IRS. So even if it's not listed specifically in the Act, the very last reason from the Act says, or you meet some other reason that the IRS decides is okay. That's pretty wide. That is pretty darn wide. So if you can prove you're impacted, you can take out up to $100,000. And the key is, like Chris just mentioned, you don't have to show a financial need commensurate with the $100,000. If it cost you $10 to hire someone to babysit your kid one day, theoretically speaking, Chris, you just qualified. Hey, I had to hire a babysitter, paid them $10 because my kid's being schooled from home and I needed to go to the store and buy groceries. That technically qualifies. And then you can take $100,000 out. That's how crazy this law was rushed through. It doesn't say you can only take $10 out, the cost of the babysitter. There's no place in there that I saw that. Now, it does say unable to work because they lack child care as a result. Now, one could argue, hey, I was home. I couldn't work because I'm taking care of my child who's attending homeschool. But I needed to go get groceries, so I had to hire a babysitter. I just feel they rushed this law through, folks, and didn't pay attention to how liberal these rules were. Or maybe they did know how liberal they were, Chris, and they just wanted people to get the financial relief some people are going to need. I don't know. But what I'm saying, what Chris is saying, and what the Ed Slot group is saying, it's not a blanket, go ahead and withdraw $100,000. But the rules allowing you to withdraw $100,000 are pretty darn liberal. And if you feel you qualify, The key is, remember, folks, you self-certify to the custodian, you qualify. It's going to be up to the IRS to audit you over the next 3 years and question whether or not you qualified or not. And I just don't see that happening, Chris. Do you?
I can't imagine they're going to start doing that. Just the optics of that would be bad. And the intent of this is to help people out. So I think they've come to the conclusion, they just don't admit it, that there will be a certain number of people that kind of bend the rules a bit or take advantage of the intent of this. But that's okay because it'll help so many other people who really need the help. That's my guess is their approach.
Now, if they audit you folks, bear in mind, most audits, the vast, vast majority of audits are done with letter audits. And it wouldn't surprise me, Chris, because they got 3 years. If maybe this settles down and 2 years from now, 3 years from now, they're sending a letter out to people saying, hey, you took $100,000 out. Can you just provide proof that you suffered a COVID-related issue and you qualified for this withdrawal? So just make sure, folks, you can back up that you were impacted by this scenario. And everyone essentially could argue my hours were reduced, or I had to self-quarantine based on what the state told me, or you might have definitely lost your job or lost some hours or been furloughed. So it's going to be rather liberal to qualify, but it's not a blanket everybody qualifies. Just be prepared to back it up. Okay, so then I went on and wrote to them. With that set of facts, I was wondering if you guys could share your thoughts on the following strategy, specifically these questions I have that are running through my mind. Question one, if you qualify for a COVID-related withdrawal, could you theoretically take $100,000 out now and immediately put it in a Roth IRA as a conversion, but spread the taxes out over 3 years? Keep in mind, let's assume you do qualify for a COVID-related withdrawal, and there's no questioning that. My gut says no. It seems to be against the spirit of the law, but at the same time, I have yet to see anything specifically that says you cannot do that. So that was my first question to the Ed Slot group. They wrote back. That's exactly, Jim, how we would see it too. Nothing in the CARES Act says a qualified individual who can take a COVID-related withdrawal can't do what you just asked. But it does, in our opinion, go against the spirit of the law, which is to help those who are in desperate need of money. So be warned, it is quite likely that the IRS will issue guidance at some point saying they are not going to allow this strategy. You better make sure any withdrawal that your clients take are aware of all these risks. Now, they said clients, they didn't know I was talking about this on the podcast where you people are my listeners. Pretty explicit answer there, do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I wish it was a little firmer conclusion that yes or no, and like they had some kind of secret connection to the IRS who filled them in on how the IRS is going to deal with this. But I think that's as good an answer as there is out there right now, because I've seen nothing that perfectly clarifies this. Even though their response to you was a few days ago, I believe, so it's got a little age on it. As of today, when we're recording this, which is April 14th, no longer tax day eve, since that got pushed back, but on the 14th of April, maybe by the time you listen to this, they've come out with clarity on this. But as we're recording this on April 14th, this is still an open situation where I totally agree with the way you described our stance. I'm on board with that, and I'm happy to see someone with the intellect and resources of the Ed Slott technical experts or technical assistants or consultants kind of agree with us that it is kind of gray area. Nothing seems to prevent it, but it is against the spirit of the law.
Now, what I would keep in mind as well, folks, is an item, and Ed didn't get into it in this answer, or the consultants didn't get into it in this answer, is a, I guess, a tax item or a tax fact is not the right word I'm looking for. But anyways, it's called the step doctrine rule. If something is not allowed and you're following certain steps to do something you normally couldn't do, the IRS won't allow it. So if you took $100,000 out on Monday and put it into a Roth IRA the following Monday, didn't spend any of that money on personal needs, didn't use that money to cover any loss of income or any loss because you were furloughed or because you are self-quarantining, you just took it out and put it in a Roth, I think they're going to say that is a conversion, you owe taxes in 2020. That's what I think they're going to say. There's nothing against taking the money out and putting it into a Roth, so you're not going to get in trouble on that. The question is, are you allowed to spread those taxes out over 3 years?
Right. That's a good point that you're making there, that the ability to do a $100,000 conversion is absolutely there if you want to do that. As long, and in this case, since there's no RMDs from almost every kind of account this year, you can do a conversion without having taken an RMD yet, because there is no RMDs in 2020 for most people's basic retirement accounts like IRAs that you might be wanting to do that with. So you can absolutely do that. The question is, the crux of this really is, can I take advantage of that three-year extension, the spreading out of the taxes over 3 years while doing a conversion rather than just a distribution for use in COVID-19 related expenses?
Exactly. So the gentleman who emailed us was thinking of things a little differently, maybe looking at the step doctrine or the IRS coming out and saying, hey, if you took that money out and put it back into a Roth in 2020, we're considering that a conversion and taxes are due all at once. We talked a couple of weeks ago that someone in the FDA form that I follow said that's what the IRS would do, but gave no explanation to that at all, just said if you put it into a Roth in 2020, it's going to be all taxable to you. Maybe that was his interpretation or his thought process that the IRS was going to take, but right now we see nothing on this. So, but be warned, folks, if you're thinking of doing this, I would try to do something similar to what our emailer said. So I continued with my question to Ed Slott Group. I said, let's change the facts around a little, and on question two, let's assume you took the $100,000 out and began paying taxes on it over a three-year period, but left the money invested in a brokerage account. It is my understanding you need to pay one-third the taxes each year, and you do this simply by declaring one-third of the withdrawal as income each year for the next 3 years. Or is it more complicated than that? And their answer back to me was, nope, no more complicated than what you just described. So that's how you're going to do it, folks. So I started wording this a little bit of what this gentleman was saying. He's not saying he's going to take this money out, put it in a Roth right away. I don't think you could do that. Chris doesn't think you can do that. The Ed Slott Group doesn't think you can do that. But nothing in the law says you can't do that. But bear in mind, the IRS could come out at any time. They could come out on December 29th and say, hey, by the way, anyone who put the money into a Roth, it's taxable to you in 2020. That's our interpretation. So you got to be real careful that they don't come out with a ruling later in the year after you put it into a Roth and now you realize you can't spread the taxes out over 3 years. So I took it and says, well, what if he puts it in a brokerage account? Nothing in the law says you actually have to spend that money. It simply says you are allowed to take the money out if you qualify for a COVID-19 related withdrawal. And as we already said, it's pretty liberal on that. So if you put the money into a brokerage account, you could simply declare 1/3 of the money every year on your taxes. If you took $90,000 out, just to keep this simple math, because we all know from a painful show I did a few weeks ago, doing math on the fly in my head is not a strong point of mine. So if you had $90,000 withdrawal, you would declare $30,000 a year as income. Does that make sense, Chris?
It does. I like how you picked a number that was easily divisible by three.
A much easier
Very
number.
Very nice job.
Oh, my God, that was a painful show. For people who don't think we do these on the fly, that show was living proof. Because we should have stopped it and started recording over. But we've always told our listeners this is a one show. What do we call it? We call it live recorded radio. And that poor show I did for that guy's question, my God, that was painful. Okay, so on to question three I asked. With the above set of facts, let's continue. If you make it to year three, you essentially already paid 2 years' worth of taxes. So in my example, folks, $30,000 in 2020, $30,000 in 2021. Now it's 2022. You owe another $30,000 in taxes.
Well, taxes on $30,000.
Yes, excuse me, not $30,000 in taxes. Taxes on $30,000 of income.
Right.
In year three, could you then simply take $100,000 and put it into a Roth IRA tax-free as the payback? Since they give you 3 years to put the money back. And I didn't mean at all. You would still have to pay taxes, Chris, on the $30,000 remaining for year three. But you already paid taxes on $30,000 in 2020, another $30,000 in 2021. Now you're in 2022. You owe tax on another $30,000. But if you have the $100,000 sitting there, you could now take the $100,000 and put it all into a Roth. It doesn't have to go into a traditional IRA. Yeah. I asked, could the money go into a Roth tax-free? And their answer was, yes, you are correct.
Yep. But that takes a little of the attractiveness of doing this for the purposes of getting it in a Roth. Because the whole purposes of trying to get the whole $100,000 in now is, as the value of these accounts is down, this is the perfect time to get it into an account that will then grow again, hopefully, tax-free. So you miss out on all the tax-free growth. What you're doing here is trading. Normally, if you just left it in the traditional account for things to, let's assume, I don't know if this is going to happen, let's assume over the next 3 years that the value of your investments goes back up from where it is today. If you left it in the traditional account, all of that gain is going to be taxed at income tax rates when you take it out in the future. By taking it out and kind of shielding it in the brokerage account, like Jim is mentioning in this listener's question, and then putting it into the Roth at the end of that in the third year, as he described here, the $90,000 is going to be exposed. Well, the gain on that $90,000, assuming things have come back, is going to be affected or taxed at capital gains rates rather than income tax rates that would have applied to those gains over the three-year period if they were kept in the traditional account. So there is possibly some advantage there tax-wise, but it isn't as glorious as the technique that we started this whole conversation was proposed of doing the conversion effectively all in 2020, getting it all into the Roth, spreading out the taxes over 3 years, and having all the rebound growth, assuming there is rebound growth, all tax-free growth, having them in that brokerage account during the three-year period, at least 2+ year period till you get to year three, is just going to move them over to the capital gains taxation category instead. So not quite as beautiful as the first approach that we were analyzing, that pretty much everyone said probably a no-go.
Exactly. And what I want to point out is, again, as I counseled with the Ed Slot group, and if people are wondering, I always just assume everyone's a longtime listener and they know the Ed Slot group and why Chris and I place a lot of emphasis on what the Ed Slot group says. I belong to a group of advisors. We are called IRA. What does Ed call us? IRA Advisors Group, that's what he calls us. Goodness, I couldn't remember what the heck he calls us. There's about 400 of us. Ed Slot is a national known CPA who teaches advisors how to understand and work with IRAs, the taxes, the planning strategies on IRAs, 401ks, anything to do with retirement and taxes. I've been studying with Ed 10 years now. My 10-year anniversary, Chris, has already been hit. So 10 years now I've been studying with Ed. So we place a lot of value on what they tell us, and we pay them, or I pay them, a lot of money to belong to their group, so they will take the time to read through acts and laws and interpret what these acts and laws and internal revenue codes mean, and then they can share with us what they mean. So we place a lot of value on this. That's why we talk openly about the Ed Slot group. If you follow PBS television, you probably have heard Ed and watched Ed. He does a lot of retirement-related presentations as fundraisers for PBS television. He's really big with PBS and helping them. So if you've never heard of Ed, Google him. If you have heard of Ed, look through your PBS directory and see which shows, which stations rather, will be carrying Ed. And he does pretty good. He's a good public speaker, and you'll enjoy listening to him. Okay, back to this, Chris. Here's my take. After the Ed Slot group pretty much put the kibosh on taking the $100,000 out, putting it into a Roth IRA and spreading the taxes out, where they said and admitted, there's nothing that says you can't do it, but there's nothing that says you can. And their big worry is the IRS is going to come back after the fact and say you can't, and then it's too late. But without that, I don't understand what the listener that got me to email this question to Ed was even driving at. So you take it out, you put it in a brokerage account, you spread the taxes out over 3 years, and then you put it all back in, the $100,000. Mm-hmm. Why not just convert one-third, one-third, one-third every year? There you spread it out, and the growth as it's rebounding is inside the Roth. Why not just convert? If you wanted to do $100,000, not that I can do the math in my head, so let's just say $90,000, convert $30,000 year one, another $30,000 year two, another $30,000 year three. You spread the taxes out over 3 years, and you got the money into a Roth.
Faster than delaying it all until the third year. And so it's that's I totally agree that doing this and holding it outside, even though you're going to possibly have that capital gains tax benefit for the growth that's going to sit there, you can't shove that into the Roth ultimately. So all that's going to end up in the Roth is the $90,000 or the $100,000, whatever total amount that we're talking about here. You're not going to do that growth part in there. And I don't think the benefits of having that little bit exposed to capital gains taxes rather than what you're saying, which is I agree with, converting it a third, and a third spreads the taxes out very similarly to what you're talking about, so you don't have a huge $100,000 spike in 1 year of a recognized income. That's probably net better than what this listener was proposing in his question.
Right. I mean, that's my take on it. And if it changes, we will keep you posted, folks. We beat this horse to death. I don't want to keep going on it. If the law changes or if the IRS adds clarity later and says, hey, you could put it in a Roth, we have no problem with that, we'll be the first to let you know. And everybody and their uncle will start doing massive Roth conversions. Other than that, this idea of taking it out, putting it off to the side, replacing it 3 years later, I don't get it. just convert a third, a third, a third, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
So that would be my take. The whole strategy's advantage is get it in the Roth in year one, and all the rebound growth would be tax-free, and you can spread the taxes out over 3 years. I'd love that, Chris. We just don't have enough guidance yet if it's allowed.
Yeah. So maybe consider your conversion strategies based on the fact that you will pay taxes on it all as a 2020 income recognition, and do all your calculations and strategies based on that assumption, and because that's the most likely scenario in most people's opinion.
Okay. Let's get to some different questions because we spent too much time on that. Oh, we got the ones we have to fix. So not fix, but address.
Mm-hmm.
So let me get to the ones that throw you under the bus. I say in a jokingly way. Where the heck is it?
Well, I remember the one that was mine, if you want me to.
Yeah, well, I know you remember it. I'm just trying to find it. I had it right here in front of me. Do you have it in front of you? Because I know you answered his question.
Well, I can do it in summary form, which is probably better because his email was kind of long. So,
well, I can't find his email all of a sudden, okay. So if you could, I'd
so
appreciate
it. So a few shows ago, we were discussing Monte Carlo simulations and some of the reasons why we're not big fans of it. And the basic topic that was coming up was if someone gave you a 95% confidence level in your retirement plan, essentially they're admitting that there's a 5% chance that it, quote, fails. It doesn't make it based on the projections that they're using when they run a whole bunch of different simulations is what they call them, where they're going to pretend that you experience the next 10, 20, 30 years, however long your retirement is in their plan, with randomized stock market or investment returns. And since they're going to be kind of randomized every single run or simulation, you're going to get a bunch of different outcomes. And they run up just to kind of pretend like they're running your retirement over and over and over again. And that's how basically it works. I went on in my trying to describe things simplistically, I made the comment that if an advisor had 100 clients and they ran 95%, that 5% of the clients would fail. That was not correct, and even after I said it, I felt a little uneasy with it. But he pointed out that how does that logic fit? And it really does not. Essentially, having an individual have a 95% confidence level doesn't mean you don't apply it then to the population of clients that they have and say 5% of his clients are going to fail. The scarier part is if all the clients were identical, had the same amount of assets, were invested the same, had the same distributions that were planned, if that 5% chance occurs, all of the clients would fail. So there's essentially a 5% chance that everyone who's behaving like that one model would all fail. So the point is not that 5% of the clients that any one advisor has is an appropriate way of describing it as failure. It's really opening yourself up to the chance, realizing that in any given retirement over the next 20 or 30 years, based on their projections, that you've got a 5% chance of failing. And we always propose that the thing to really look at is what happens in that, quote, fail scenario. How bad is it? And there's different degrees of failure, really, depending on your situation. And it would be good to know if things don't work out well, what is that fail? And then we always point out that the other downside that we really hate about this approach is that they always talk about the failure side, the low chance of failure, but there's also a similar low chance that you end up with a ton of money at the end under their approach, which in my mind is also a failure. But did want to clarify that what I said, I did misspeak that. I said something that is not statistically accurate. So wanted to clear that up. So luckily a listener pointed that out, and so we can clear the air on that. That's not quite how the Monte Carlo statistics are applied over several different clients. It's an individual client number.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay. Can you hear me?
I can. Did you find the other one?
Yeah, I do, but can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
All right. Can you hear me better than before?
I think it's the same.
Oh, okay. All right. I did find that email, and that's exactly what the gentleman was asking. And then we had another one, another email. This one came in just a couple, about 10 days ago now. And it begins, I just listened to your Q&A show 2014. That means the 14th show of 2020, right, Chris?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was a question related to the government FERS program. I think the answer was incomplete because it did not address federal employee health benefits, and we didn't address that. So he is correct. We did not address that. Okay. You also used the term delayed, which is not an actual option under the federal program. The correct verbiage is deferred or postponed. Mm-hmm. And he is correct on that as well. We used the wrong language. We said if someone was to delay. It's not as easy, the federal program, FERS, is not quite as straightforward as delaying Social Security. We use those terms all the time, and we just carried those terms over as we talked about the federal program. And they're not the same. So we should not have used the Social Security verbiage delayed when talking about the federal FERS program. We should use what it includes, deferring or postponing. And in short, and this doesn't apply to probably 90% of our listeners because you're not federal employees, but you might be interested in what they have. Their FERS program is essentially, folks, a pension, okay? It's a defined benefit plan. They are allowed to either defer or postpone their FERS. And depending which one they're eligible for, will determine if they're going to get health care benefits in retirement or not. You would defer your FERS pension rather than taking it out. You would defer it. In a deferral, you are not eligible for what is known as a minimum retirement age plus 10 separation. I'll explain in a minute what that means. You have at least 5 years of service, but not enough years of service to qualify for what is known as a minimum retirement age plus 10 retirement. But you do leave federal service and you stop working, but you will not, when you turn on your pension, receive federal health benefits. So in a deferral, or when you defer your FERS retirement, you have at least 5 years of credible service, and you do leave your contributions in the federal retirement system. In essence, you're going to leave service. So you went to work for maybe 6, 7, 8 years, 9 years, and you decided this isn't for me, I'm leaving. So you leave federal service, but you leave your contributions in the system. You don't take them out. Later, when you reach a specific age, and it's usually age 62, so let's call it 62, you can start receiving, Chris, your pension. But with this type of deferral, you will not get federal health benefits. But that's what you get if you leave service and you're not eligible for what is known as an MRA, minimum retirement age, plus 10. In a postponement, you have reached your minimum retirement age, and I'm not going to get into what that is and how you figure it out, but for most federal employees, you're essentially 55 to 57 years old, depending on when you were born.
It does vary based on the type of employee you are, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get too deep into that because we'll never get to any other questions.
Right.
So you've reached your minimum retirement age. Remember, in a deferral, you haven't reached your minimum retirement age. But here you've reached your minimum retirement age, and you have at least 10 years of credible service. And I won't get into what a year of credible service is and all that. There's definitions for all of this. But in essence, you're about 55 to 57, and you worked for the feds for at least 10 years. Now you leave work. You can postpone your FERS pension, and you can postpone it usually till around age 62. But when you turn on your FERS pension, you will be eligible to be in the Federal Health Benefits Program, FEHB, Federal Employee Health Benefit Coverage. So those were the two big differences. And we used the verbiage delay, and delay isn't the verbiage in either situation. It's deferred or postponed. So we used Social Security language for a program that doesn't follow Social Security rules.
Yeah.
So anyways, he just wanted to clear the air on that, and I wanted to clear the air to our listeners, for anyone who was wondering. And Chris, you wrote to this gentleman and said that we would try to get my colleague, Micah, on board and get Micah involved and maybe do a couple of shows. Micah is a very knowledgeable colleague of mine out of Alaska, of all places, but he's very knowledgeable on the federal retirement program, and maybe get him on to do a few shows. I have not spoken to Micah yet about that, but I thought, hey, that would be a pretty good thing. Let me see if he'll do it. So I'll still reach out to Micah and see.
Maybe next time you're fishing in Alaska, you guys can call in together to the show here, and we can do a little remote show from Alaska. How exciting would that be?
That would be interesting. We could be fishing mm-hmm. and doing a show.
Yeah.
I'll see if Mike is up for that. But one thing I did want to get to, this gentleman did mention in that email as an aside, he left his real name, but we're not going to use it. We'll call him, as we always do, to protect his anonymity. We're going to call him George, and he's from Virginia. But he writes, P.S., I recently read that Joe Biden is proposing to do away with some of the step-up in basis provision in the current tax code. Are there any strategic moves you would recommend if a person believes this is likely to become law? Die before the law is passed and changed. Now, I say that jokingly. Don't go commit suicide or die before. What this gentleman is asking is no surprise, because we have said repeatedly on this show that we feel the step up in basis rules will be changed. President Obama, of which Joe Biden served as vice president, President Obama, Chris, made it abundantly clear. In fact, he called the step up in basis the biggest loophole in the U.S. tax code. I feel the step up in basis rule simply says, folks, if you inherit an asset, the basis you use for determining the taxation of that asset when you sell it is the value of that asset, the fair market value of that asset on the day of death of the owner. They had that law in place, Chris, because for years, computers really didn't exist like they do today. And tracking what someone paid who may have died and has something that they bought 30 years earlier was all but impossible.
Right.
And they just said, look, we're going to allow this to be stepped up. It's the only way to do it. Nowadays, it's not as difficult tracking this. And the government realizes they are giving up a huge amount of taxable income to them being the government. It will not surprise me if someday, Chris and I have been preaching for a while, the death of the stretch IRA, and now we have the 10-year rule. And in my opinion, the five-year rule, which was always the rule, is probably going to come back eventually as well. But they have a 10-year rule now for non-spouse beneficiary. And I think, Chris, the step-up in basis is going to go the way of the dodo bird someday as well. And they're going to justify it by saying you can track basis now. It's a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to start tracking basis. As for tax planning strategies around it, listener, I can't begin telling you tax planning strategies around it because I don't know what the rule is going to say. Is it for all assets acquired after a certain period of time, which is what I could see happening, Chris? All assets acquired by the original owner after this rule takes effect would have to have their basis tracked. All assets that have been acquired before maybe won't. I'm just guessing out loud how they're going to deal with some of this. But it wouldn't surprise me if the step up in basis goes the way of the dodo bird. And keep that in mind. I don't know when, but I feel someday it will, because there are a lot of politicians, President Obama and now Joe Biden and others, I'm sure, who feel this rule is no longer fair and it's a way for people to get out of taxation, although it's a pretty harsh way of getting out of taxation. You have to die. But in the eyes of the government, it's not how much of your money you get to keep. It's how much of their money they're going to let you keep. And the government looks at all your money and all your assets as theirs, in my opinion. And they're just deciding how much of it they're going to let you keep and how much of it they're going to take. So do recognize someday, folks, I think the step up in basis rules will go away. What are your thoughts, Chris?
I do. I hope it's not just a pull the rug out from everyone. I would prefer, if it does happen, which I think odds are better than 50-50, that it will happen, that it will go away, maybe a transitional way like you mentioned, that all assets acquired after a certain date play under the new rules, but things you've had a long time where you might have made the purchase decision or investment decision in the past and based on assuming the step up existed, and you wouldn't have maybe made the same decision if it didn't. That's where it kind of penalizes people retroactively if they were to just institute it without grandfathering in existing held assets or something. So hopefully it gets pushed off a while, because it is a benefit to people who are inheriting assets that have gone up in value that are outside of retirement accounts. We all know when a person passes away with pre-tax money in a retirement account, that will eventually get taxed. There's no step up on that. But it is on other assets held outside of those accounts. The step-up has been quite valuable for those who inherit assets. So for that crowd, they're going to be very sad when this goes away. But most people in the country don't get this benefit because they don't inherit things of value like that. Most of our listeners are probably in the group of potential of having that happen. But when we look at the whole population, it's actually not that many people. And comparatively, and so I agree with what you said, that it's probably on the future chopping block. I just hope it's done in kind of a transitional way instead of all at once when it does happen, if it does.
Excellent. Okay. So let's jump into two more questions that can be answered with one answer, so we can kill two birds with one stone.
Nice.
Okay, so the first one came from someone out of Texas. We'll call them a Texan. And another one out of Texas. Well, that is weird. I wonder if they are somehow related. No, they got different emails. Hmm. Interesting. Both Texans asking this question. And it has to do with IRMA, income-related monthly adjusted amount, otherwise known as a Medicare premium surcharge, or we actually consider it, Chris, a tax.
Right.
Because it is essentially, folks, mm-hmm. an additional tax you have to pay to the government. And keep one other thing in mind on the previous tax question about the step up in basis. Another reason why I feel the step up in basis will go the way of the dodo bird, and why I feel IRMA is not ever going to go away, this government is in debt up to their eyeballs. And with this coronavirus and the trillions they are throwing at this, willy-nilly, I mean trillions upon trillions are being thrown by the federal government and the Federal Reserve. Fiscal policy and monetary policy have gone berserk, and trillions of debt is being added to the government coffers. There's no way they have the money to pay this back. And they're going to need to find revenue any way they can. And an easy way of doing it, Chris, just say, hey, this is unfair. Rich people are getting away with this. And they'll get rid of the step-up in basis. I see it coming. Okay, but I also don't see Irma going away. Irma started under the Obama administration. Was it Obama or was it Clinton who brought Irma in? I think it was Obama.
I think so, too.
I'm not 100% certain on that, but it was one of the two. It was either Clinton or Obama. I think it was Obama. And what they started doing is putting surcharges on your Medicare premiums if your income exceeded certain thresholds. Now, those thresholds are pretty high. I don't have them in front of me, Chris. Maybe you can pull them up or I can try to pull them up, but I don't seem to have them in front of me.
I can pull them real
okay.
quick.
Oh, wait a minute. No, I do have them in front of me now. If you are single and your income is below $87,000, you will not be subject to Irma. And if you are married and your income is below $174,000, your income will not be subject to Irma.
Are those the 2020 numbers? Because they did go up in 2020.
No, these are 2019 numbers.
Yeah, so they're up a little bit from that.
Okay,
it's about 90 and 180. Okay. In my mind, that's how I round them up. So
okay, so I have 2019 and it is 2020, so those numbers are a little bit higher. So these numbers are high, but they're not high enough where they're not going to snare a lot of our listeners, because our listeners tend to be more successful and have more in assets. So we got these two questions in, both from a Texan. First one, how do I appeal the income-related monthly adjusted amount? The letter we got said it can be appealed since I retired in November of 2018. Our modified adjusted gross income went from $246,000 to just $40,000 in 2019, but I'm being asked to pay an Irma surcharge. Then the other person writes, hi, Jim and Chris. Great show. Enjoy the podcast. My wife, not so much. She doesn't like the Boston accent. I almost not answered this question because of that. So apparently his wife is a Texan who doesn't like people who talk with a Boston accent.
I haven't seen this question.
It's a new one, and I'm only answering it because it's very close to the other one. And I thought, well, I can answer two questions at once. It's not your fault, my accent. We just listen really slow down here. So maybe I talk too fast. I like how he puts it's not your fault. I have two questions. And then he says, my wife turns 65 in December of 2021. We sold our small business May of 2019. I will turn 65 February of 2022. My first question is this. When my wife files for her Medicare in December of 2021, will the sale of our business in 2019 impact us? What's one unique thing, Chris? What tax return did they look at for Irma surcharges?
It's the tax return from two tax years before the year in which the Medicare premiums are being collected. So her Medicare premiums in 2022, if she turns in December, there's only 1 month of 2021.
But let's address that one, the 2021 one.
Yep. She that one is going to have that affected by Irma, that 1 month, if their 2019 return reflects income or modified adjusted gross income, technically, of greater than the limits that we just discussed on that return. So they're going to base it on that unless you have, I like to call it an excuse, but they technically call it a life-changing event, and there's a list of those.
And that, we'll get into that because that's part of the answer. Yep.
Yeah.
So Chris is correct, folks. What's going to happen in this case? He sold a business in 2019, and he's asking, will the sale of the business subject me to IRMA? Well, what they're going to look at is your modified adjusted gross income for IRMA-related purposes, which is simply your adjusted gross income, or AGI, which is pretty much everything you've earned, plus tax-free interest on certain things. So, yes, the sale of your business, no matter how it was it taxed as a profit because your business was sold and you had some equipment in it that you sold as a profit? Was it taxed as goodwill, which is going to be subject maybe to income taxes to you? Was it a capital gain? I don't know. You didn't get into how this business was sold and how it's being taxed to you. But irrespective if it's taxed you as a capital gain, if it's taxed you as recaptured goodwill, if it was a profit, whatever, it's going to find its way onto your 1040 and your adjusted gross income. And then from that, or to that, you're going to add tax-free interest and a few other line items that get added into that. And that's going to determine your modified adjusted gross income for purposes of IRMA. So yes, your business will find its way onto your 2019 taxes. However, it's only going to impact your wife in 2 years later. So 2019 will impact you in 2021. You are not 65 yet. Your wife, who doesn't like Bostonians, is turning 65. But she doesn't get on Medicare until December, Chris, 1 month.
Right.
So you're going to have 1 month of a Medicare premium surcharge for a non-life-changing event. The sale of a business, in my opinion, does not meet the definition of a life-changing event, which I'm going to get to answer the first question I read in a second. But then he said, hey, I turn in February of 2022, pretty early in 2022, I turned 65. Will the sale of my business somehow suck me into IRMA? And no. The sale, what's going to impact you, listener, is what happens to you this year. 2020's taxes right. will impact the Medicare premiums for 2022. And they always look back 2 years, not on purpose. It's just because of how slow the system works. Look at it this way. When do you file your 2019 taxes, listener? April 15th of 2020. Now July.
Or as late as October if you get an extension.
If you file an extension. So they can't base your 2019 Medicare premiums on 2019 because 2019 doesn't even get filed until 2020. I suppose they could bill you in arrears, but that would really cause people to get upset over this. So instead, what they say is your 2019 taxes, which has the sale of the business, you're going to file them in 2020. We're going to look at them in 2020 and apply it to your 2021 Medicare premiums.
Right.
So they're essentially looking back 2 years, folks. So the sale of your business in 2019, listener, impacts your wife for 1 month, but will not impact you when you file for your benefits in February of 2022.
Right.
They're going to look at what you did in 2020.
And it doesn't continually affect his wife either. It'll only affect for December, and then the January and beyond will be based then on 2020 tax information. And hopefully if 2020 is okay for them both, neither one will be experiencing IRMA in 2022 and beyond.
Exactly. Now let's get to, and this man has a second question, which I'll get to in a second, but let's get to the first question. Here is someone who was making and earned $246,000 in 2018. Here it is 2020, Chris, and they're being hit with Irma surcharges. Now, that makes sense, listeners. 2018 taxes were filed in 2019. Social Security Administration and Medicare look at your 2019 tax return and will apply it to your 2020 Medicare premiums. So no surprise there. However, they're saying, but now we're retired. And in 2019, we think we're only going to earn $40,000. Why should we have to pay Medicare premiums? We're not making this kind of money anymore. So for you, listener, you have to go to Social Security Form 44, SSA-44. Now, get the one for the latest tax year. I pulled up 2019s, but you can get 2020s. But it's SSA-44, simply titled Medicare Income-Related Monthly Adjusted Amount Life-Changing Event Form. This is where you report, hey, I know you're penalizing me because in 2018 I made $246,000, but that ain't going to happen again. It was a life-changing event. You file this form, and they will lower your Medicare premiums if they agree with it. Now, this form is lengthy. It's 8 pages, and you got to do some math work in it. I'm not going to bore you with it. I'm just going to list what the life-changing events are.
Well, the good news is you only have to fill out 2 or 3 of those 8. The rest of them are instructions.
True. There's a lot of instructions, and there's, I think, 4 or 5 steps. Yeah. There are 5 steps.
And just so people know, with that $240-some-thousand figure, married filing joint, just so you know the effects of the Irma, it doubles the Medicare premium for 2020 if they are at that level in 2018 for their earnings. So instead of $145 a month per person, it's double that. It's $290 per month for the Part B premium. And if they have Part D, it increases their Part D premiums by about $32 as well. So the total penalty is about $175 a month per person that's affected by this if they didn't get this appeal approved. In their description, one of the life-changing events is work reduction is what it's called. It's not technically called retirement.
Work stoppage. Reduction.
Work stoppage or reduction, yeah. Those two, that's the phrases they use that would capture retirement in there. Work stoppage, obviously, if you're fully retired. But if you do partial retirement, you had a sudden drop in their working part-time, making half of what they were before, that would fall into the work reduction category.
So exactly. So the categories are marriage, divorce, death of your spouse. If it's you, you're not being billed anymore.
True.
Work stoppage. Work reduction, loss of income-producing property, loss of pension, and an employer settlement.
Payment, yeah. So
yes. And all of these are defined in there. And the work reduction or work stoppage, you do have to prove it. So you can look at that form. They're very explicit on what proof you have to send them. You don't just fill in the form and sign it and ask them to believe you like you can with the $100,000 COVID withdrawal. You quote-unquote self-certify that, meaning you just tell them no proof required. They're going to take you at your word, and only if they question it will they ask for proof. On this one, they don't believe you. You got to send in proof with the form, sign the form, send in the proof. They list what the proof is. So if you no longer work, you have to get something. I don't have that page open. You get that page open, and what they got to do, they got to get something from their employer. I think a letter from the employer.
If they don't have something better that's an official document, they can get a letter from their employer.
Right. So you got to get something.
Work reduction.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to win, listener. If that $246,000 of income was because you were working and you were pulling in that as salary and now you're retired, you get the proof, you submit it, and you will not have to pay that higher premium. So you can appeal it that way. Now, one thing I will say, true story here, I was chatting with a colleague who was saying at lunch, I told you, the lunch is where we do all our networking, was claiming that he was taking or claiming Roth conversions were exemptions under this form. And if you do a Roth conversion, it would not subject your clients to IRMA. I was like, dude, what are you smoking? Of course Roth conversions are. They are not an exempt life-changing event. You know what he was clinging on, Chris?
Not something strong, because I agree with what you said.
Loss of income-producing property. He said he was checking on that.
What?
And I said, have you ever read the form, I told him? Have you looked at what that means? It means you literally had an income-producing property that was in a federal or state-declared disaster area, and you lost it, or you suffered a total catastrophic loss like it burned down. He was claiming, through the conversion, you were losing the income of the RMDs, and you were losing income-producing property.
Whoa.
I don't know if this guy truly was filing it or claiming it, because when you fill out this form, you can clearly see it's not going to float. Or if he was just thinking this would work. But he and I argued to this point, and I finally ended up, because I got his business card, I ended up emailing him this proof, and he wrote back to me something to the effect of, well, I guess it wouldn't work then, but it was a good try. And I don't know if he actually tried this or counseled clients to go ahead and do conversions that you could claim a loss of income-producing property.
Mm, yeah.
You can't. I just want to set the record straight, folks. A conversion, a gambling winning, a sale of an investment property or something that triggered a big cap gain, none of that is an exemption. None of it. Don't try to get creative. It isn't going to work.
But the good news is it's only if it was a singular year event, a single year event, it will only affect your Medicare premiums for 1 year, 2 years after. So it's not like a permanent penalty where you're suddenly shunned to a box of always paying double the Medicare Part B premiums or something like that. If it truly was a transient, short-term event, the Medicare IRMA will be a transient, short-term event for you as well. So that's a little bit of good news, I guess, to cling to.
Absolutely, and it's just another calculation that goes into your Roth conversion analysis. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be worth paying 1 year's worth of Medicare premium surcharges? Hopefully, if it's a married couple, they've got bigger cliffs, if you will, bigger brackets, and only one of them will be on Medicare at the time. And sometimes it is worth, or oftentimes one could argue it would be worth, to bite the bullet, have that one spouse pay Medicare premium surcharges for 1 year to get a bigger amount in a Roth IRA and lower your RMDs to keep both spouses from being subject to Medicare premium surcharges in the future. It's something that needs to be factored and considered, but Chris is correct. It's a one-time deal. They're going to look at your tax return every single year and do this calculation. But loss of income-producing property, you cannot claim through my Roth conversion, I'm reducing income because my RMDs are dropping. That's not going to float the boat. No. It's not going to work. Okay, perfect. So I wanted to get those two questions answered.
Okay. Nice. Well, you have anything else to say before we sign off? Because we got to get going here.
Oh, that was it? All right. Well,
we got to release people. These are starting to go longer and longer, and people are going to start feeling trapped for too long, I think, on this podcast. So.
Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up then. There was a second question that IRMA person asked, but I will answer it on a future show.
Perfect. So thanks for calling in again. I'll wrap up and we'll see you again.
All right. Well, thanks, folks. I'm going to hang up. Chris is going to give a little spiel for the ending, and we'll be in touch on the next Q&A show. Thanks for listening.
So everybody who wants to send in their own question to the Q&A show, very simple. Go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find a contact form where you can send it in. That's the best way, on the contact form, because then both Jim and I get a copy of it, can take a look at it. And kind of the more concise you can make your question, the better the chance we'll be able to dig it out quickly from the pile and add it to one of these shows. If it's a really long and drawn out question, those are usually going to be turned into an EDU show, or maybe a little piece of your question will be picked out. But anything that's concise and rules-based or a clarification, or, hey, I'm trying to do this, can I do it or not? Those are great questions. We usually try to pick those out first because we think that those are most helpful to people who are listening. So jimhelps.com is the place to go for that. And in the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll all get through this, hopefully sooner than later. But I think everyone here, we're pretty resilient as a population. I think everything's going to turn out okay. So thanks, everybody, for listening in this trying time. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.